Like to. Like to reconvene or come back to order, I guess, from our recess from earlier today and continue hearing testimony on Senate File 1824, Senator Nino's bill. And apologize for the interruption. Mr. Bartsch, you were kind of in the middle of a presentation. We got sort of sidetracked, and I want to, I hope, give you the opportunity to have collected your thoughts and to start from wherever you need to continue. So. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, again, my name is Jeff Bartsch, here today representing Medica and also speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. As the hearing ended, when we broke before, I leaned over to Senator Nienau and let him know that part of my testimony that I hadn't gotten to yet was to express that the health plans aren't opposed to a new audit. As I mentioned earlier, these are large contracts. There's a lot of dollars involved. We certainly believe it's appropriate for taxpayers and the legislature to feel that there is accountability of and that you, the legislature, are accountable for the use of those dollars. But as you look at the language that's in Senate File 1824, I'd ask you to consider a few questions, and particularly given the handout that I delivered earlier and some of the comments and questions from the earlier testimony. The first question is the legislature or the state going to receive either more information or better information than what's currently reported through the existing contract between the plans and the Department of Human Services? Is the information not currently audited be audited better, or is it a more valuable audit under the law or the bill before you than what's happening today, and does it give you greater certainty about the accuracy of the information? Is the right information getting to the appropriate persons? That's two things. One is, are you and others getting the right information, but also, two, making sure that information isn't getting to those where it's not appropriate. And finally, is the information that's going to be gathered through this audit process or through this legislation answer the questions that all of you as legislators and others have to make sure that you are accountable for the use of the dollars in these programs? And I raised that last issue in particular given some of the testimony we had earlier today, much of which focused around payment to providers, which isn't directly addressed in the bill before you. And if I can just take a moment to talk about provider payment and what's currently available. We discussed the encounter data earlier today, so clearly every provider knows what they are getting paid by each health plan and by the state directly through the fee-for-service system. Each provider has that information. We also have, through the report, or at least one report that's been delivered from the Department of Human Services, pretty detailed information about what each of the plans pays each provider type for a set of services. Last January, the Department of Human Services released a report on provider reimbursement that spells out average reimbursement for physicians, dentists, for a number of procedures, birth, etc., by each of the health plans and also by each of the programs. So you can look, for example, and see on average one health plan pays $40 for a preventive dental visit and another health plan on average pays $28 for a dental visit. That information was reported last year. I don't know if the department's going to produce that level of report again, but they have the data through the collection of the encounter data to produce those types of reports. So I don't know that it's fair to suggest that providers don't know where the money is spent. I think they clearly do, and I think if you look at the information that's both in our audited financial statements and also what the department has produced, that answers those questions. Mm-hmm. I would like to address one of the handouts earlier. Mr. Ryman handed out this chart showing cumulative rate increases to the health plans and also the rate variation or the fee variation for providers. And I've seen this chart before, and quite frankly, it's quite misleading. And it's misleading because it's comparing two separate things. It's comparing the total revenue to the health plans, which is a factor of the fee we receive, multiplied by the volume of enrollees we have. And it's comparing that to the specific fee for providers without multiplying it by volume. And so what you get is total revenue compared to the fee. And that's not a fair comparison. If you were to compare the total revenue increases to the health plans or by the health to the health plans, compare that to the total revenue increases for the providers, you'd see the same growth. And in fact, if you looked at the fees paid to the health plan over time, you would see, much like the fees to the providers, they are not growing at this level. In fact, the fees paid to the health plans on a per member per month basis decreased from 2010 until 2011. And Mr. Chairman, you introduced a bill last year that would have frozen rates at the 2010 level, and it clearly showed in the fiscal note. Maybe that wasn't such a good idea because you actually paid us less in 2011 than you did in 2010. I just raise that to point out that when you look at total revenue to the health plans and compare that to total revenue for the providers, you get the same growth. When you only compare revenue to fee, you get a chart that looks like this, even if you change the labels around, and this graph shows provider revenue, and this graph shows health plan fees. You need to compare apples to apples when you're talking about payment increases moving forward. So, Mr. Chairman, in summary, I'd just like to say again, we do support transparency. We feel like there is a level of transparency, but if a new audit or this new audit provides you as the policymakers greater certainty about the accuracy of the information, we're certainly not opposed to that. These are the programs that you manage, and we feel that you need to be comfortable with the management of those programs. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Barch. Are there questions from the committee for the witness at this point? There may be some questions, so I'd ask if you might hang around a little bit until we get through. I would like to ask the department if they would want to just come forward and comment on the proposal and perhaps respond to some of the questions that have been raised about Welcome, Commissioner. Thank you for adjusting your schedule to be here today. I appreciate it. And Mr. Lights, I don't know if you either of you have a comment that you'd like to make to begin with, or if you just wanted to field a few questions, or what?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Cindy Jessen, Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. I can make a few comments, if that's all right with you, Mr. Chair, and then answer questions. My comments will be brief. I do want to start out by saying that the department supports what I'm now calling, after some of the testimony I heard earlier this afternoon, the no-holds-barred independent third-party audit. You know, I think just being part of these hearings and talking to a number of folks, it's clear to me that there is some public mistrust of the way that we have in the past contracted with health plans. And I don't think we can just wish that away. We need to address it, and I think that independent audits are a good way of doing that. I did have two concerns about the bill, and one really was the breadth of the audit firm exclusions that was in the bill. I was concerned because if we're going to do audits, we should do audits right, that those exclusions were so broad we weren't going to be able to find a firm with the relevant expertise to be able to do these audits. I must say that, Senator Nienau, your A1 amendment with a three-year look back, I mean, went a long ways to addressing that concern for me. I'd be interested in, you know, other people who have more expertise in me weighing in on that. So I appreciate that, Senator. And I also had some more questions about what real-time encounter data, which is in subsection F of this, what that meant. That was talked about a bit earlier in the testimony, and I also had some of those questions. You know, as earlier testifiers mentioned, we, starting last May, we do now get this encounter data, and we get it on a monthly basis. Now, from the department's perspective, more rapid submission would be good. But if real time means instantly, frankly, Mr. Chair, members, we couldn't keep up with that. So anything more than weekly would be a stretch, but anything more than that would be, if that's what it is intended, we just, with the staff we had, couldn't keep up. And also, I say that not just because of a staffing level, but we're not trying to think of just getting the data, but when we get the data, we need to make sure it's accurate. And we also need to obviously make sure that its privacy is maintained. So that was just a concern I had, you know, which I think others have. But we support third-party independent audits. But I think the encounter data does take me to a bit of a bigger picture, if you'll indulge me, Mr. Chair. And that is that we have, over the last year and a few months, made some progress on these transparency and pricing issues. Not on fee-for-service rates, which I understand is a concern, and I think it's a very legitimate concern that we heard about this afternoon. We've gone somewhat a little backwards on that. But if you think about it, the health plans didn't used to provide DHS with encounter data. Now they do. And we now know where those dollars are going, and we're going to report, be very clear in reporting that out. As Mr. Bartsch says, we've already started to do that. The governor, in his executive order, where he ordered competitive bidding and the transparency website, also directed us to do an annual transparency report, which we'll be issuing this summer, looking at that whole first year of data that we have, that encounter data. So we will be, you know, once again, even in more detail, you know, giving information broadly about how providers are being paid by health plans. We do want to, as we do that, you know, not reveal personal data, obviously. And we don't, and we want to do it in a way that isn't so specific that it stifles competition. Because I do think that we need more competition, not less, to drive down prices. Which brings me, if I can say something quickly on the pricing front, since that's been raised, and I share some of the concerns that were mentioned about the chart, because I think some of those numbers in the chart represent a lot of enrollment in our public programs, enrollment a lot of since 2008 because of the recession. But certainly, having said that, when I joined as commissioner, I was troubled, not just by the lack of transparency, but more so, frankly, because I didn't think the department was driving the hardest bargain that it should have been driving with the health plans. But once again, I do think we have made some progress. With competitive bidding, last year we agreed to, and it was in the legislative proposal, as all of you know, and certainly you do, Mr. Chair, that we, the PMAP rates in the metro, we took a 13% decrease relative to forecast. And if the forecast had built in a 6% increase, so that's a 7% just less overall in our payments. And we also include, the legislature also included, and the governor signed a cap on those payments in the next 3 years on rates. So I do think what we will see in the future is, you know, is much more constraint on a different number of different fronts. And even looking at 2011, I would note that the profits for 2011 will be capped at 1%, which is under a contract amendment that the plans agreed to and that we negotiated with them. So while I think there is much to do, Mr. Chair and members, and I believe that a no-holds-barred approach to audits should be part of that work that we should do together, I do also think we should not lose sight of the progress that we are making.
Thank you, Commissioner. I do want to I don't know if whether you or Mr. Leitz may be willing or able to answer. I do have a copy. I got a copy of sort of the generic contract that you have with the plans. I think they're all kind of in this format, but this is one that is just generic. And I want to just clarify that, as I understand this contract, the way it's written is that the risk lies with the plans in its entirety. In other words, when you enter a negotiation with the plans to set a rate or to set a total compensation structure and you agree on whatever dollar amount that might be within the constraints of whatever the legislature authorizes, if the costs turn out to be greater than that, those additional costs under the contract are borne by the plan. I see you nodding. I just want to make sure I understand this. If there are cases where, because either the forecast or the anticipation of what was needed turned out to be not quite as much as we needed, as such as we've seen recently, or if the work that is being done is done at a lower cost than what was originally planned, then you have a situation where you've paid a certain amount of money and the plans have covered the required people with the required services at lower than that cost, and so there's a difference. Now, my understanding is that's what, in the plan world, they call, their margin, or the difference between what, and that would end up being transferred to reserves. Is that your understanding of how this works?
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding of how it works.
And so We are not permitted, as I understand it, to, if in a year where the plans have a negative situation, we do not come and make them whole. That's not permitted. Is that also correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
So if, in your view as a department, is it worth contemplating to say, in the event that the plans, for whatever reason, provide coverage at a lower cost, and so therefore they have this margin, should that be recaptured by the state automatically when that situation occurs, in your view?
Mr. Chair, if I may answer in a couple of sentences. You know, actually, I took a long look at those contracts last year when, you know, we were in this budget crisis, and I'd seen some of the, you know, reserves in the plans and some of the, and I knew how much money they were making off our contracts. I didn't see any way, I'm just one lawyer, but that I could have gone back and said, oh, hey, you have to give me money back. That is why I did turn to the plans and say, let's negotiate a cap. But if I thought I could have just, as the department done, as government done that, maybe in our budget crisis I would have been tempted to, but I did not see that as an option legally, which is why we negotiated the cap.
So, and I'm sure that we've had periods where you've had that kind of fluctuation in terms of what the contract paid and what the plans were able to provide, and sometimes been positive, sometimes been negative. But I guess I'm just trying to understand if it's the thought of the department or going forward that we should devise a way to capture that, or, to your point, if you get to a situation where you've got some a year where you end up paying more, does that just mean that the next year you drive a harder bargain? Is that what you're suggesting?
That is, Mr. Chair, that is part of what I'm suggesting. I do think, Mr. Chair, that there are some options we are looking at the department in the future. Should we be doing, I mean, the plans have sometimes suggested doing risk corridors, which would be a different model. In our demonstration projects, we're looking at shared savings models, both on the upside and the downside, which would mean we would be taking some, you know, we would be taking some risk, but then we would be sharing in some of the savings. While they're different models that we are looking to see if they work better for Minnesota, which I think we should be pursuing, you know, all the contracts up to this point have relied upon, just as you described, you know, we're contracting with the plans, they are taking the risk. And I think with the hard bargain we did drive last year through the competitive bidding, it will be more of a risk for them, frankly.
Okay. And one last thing I want to clarify. I also am trying to understand this. Isn't it the case that our law requires that as a condition of licensure that the plans must enter into a contract with the state to provide these services?
Mr. Chair, I read that law a little differently than that. When we were doing the competitive bidding, the way we looked at that law is we viewed that law as requiring each of the plans to put forth a good faith bid, but that didn't necessarily mean they were entitled to a contract or that they had to have a contract with us.
But I guess, Commissioner, that I guess what I was saying is it's not possible for a plan to decline to bid, is my point, is that we have the law says that if you're going to be a HMO licensed in the state of Minnesota, you must bid in good faith on this business, whether or not you want to or whatever. It's just a requirement. And I agree with you. It doesn't mean that they would necessarily get the business, but they are required to put in a good faith bid. Is that fair?
Mr. Chair, that's a fair statement.
Okay. All right. Are there questions for the witness? Mr. Lights, were you going to make any comment at this point, or just here to answer questions?
Just here to answer questions, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Thank you. I do want to I appreciate your being here, and I think I did want to see if there was any more questions. I want to talk a little bit about the reserves, but maybe that would be something that the people from the plans could address, and I think there may be a couple of amendments, so I appreciate your being here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I'm wondering if we could have representative, maybe if Mr. Bartsch is here still, to come back and talk a little bit about the, because we have heard some testimony about the reserves and the profits or the margins or whatever the proper terminology is in your world, can you provide the committee with some testimony about how that works and maybe even give us a little bit of history about that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, my name is Jeff Barsh. I'll try to provide a little background. Reserves are essentially the savings account for health insurers or HMOs. HMOs are no different than any small business or a local unit of government or a school district or a person or your family, and that they hold savings to address unforeseen expenses, to make sure that they're adequately protecting themselves against things they can't see. So the fact that insurers or HMOs hold reserve or savings is not unique. Everyone does that. The uniqueness is that because reserves or the having financial security in the bank is so important when you're selling insurance, is that we're required to have it. So everyone else has reserves or capital or savings or surplus. We're required to. And the reason we're required to is the regulators want to make sure that if I sell someone a policy, an HMO policy, and that policy says I'm going to cover your medical expenses, and for an HMO that means for as long as you hold the policy with no limit on those expenses, they make sure I have the money in the bank to do that. They are protecting against me or another health insurer saying, I'm broke, I'm sorry you bought a policy from me, but I'm out of here, and good luck to you. And that has occurred in the state before. So reserves are a necessity. They're a requirement, and they're measured because of that. So we're unique in two ways. One, we're required to have them, and two, because we're required, we're the only ones where you actually measure reserves and report on them. And I think the fact that they're reported gives them more attention than the reserves or capital you would find for other nonprofits or anything else. The other thing to remember is reserves are there to protect our entire book of business. So reserves are there to protect us as a business, not just the Medicaid program, but our individual insurance, our small group, our commercial, Medicare, everything else. We hold reserves to protect our entire book of business. They've been built off our entire book of business. So for Medica, we've had reserves since we were first licensed as an HMO since 1974. The state didn't move to the PMAP program as a pilot until the late 80s. It didn't go mandatory statewide until 96. So we had reserves in place for 22 years before this program went statewide. That's a long explanation to lead to what happens on a year-to-year basis. Because we're nonprofits, on any given year, if our margins are greater, or if we have a margin, if our revenue is greater than our expenses, we're required to put that money into reserve. And we calculate that by, at the end of the year, we look at not just one line of business, but we look at all of our lines of business. And if we have a margin, that goes into our reserves. If we have a margin on the Medicaid program, that is factored in with the margins we may have on our commercial and other business. The net result of that goes into reserves. If you look at year-to-year margins for the Medicaid program or any other state program, you can see what our margin was for that program. That doesn't necessarily equate to what went into the reserves for that year. You can look at it and say, well, that's the piece of their business that would contribute to any contribution to reserve, but it's not always an equal thing because, again, reserves are a result of all of our books of business, not just Medicaid. That's a short explanation, Mr. Chairman. If there's other questions about that, I'm happy to try and answer them.
All right. Are there questions?
Mr. Chairman, not a question, but a general comment, because I do have to leave for a few minutes. But in terms of the reserves and so on, I just wanted to note that last year that the health plans, almost less than half of their revenue came from the public programs, but more than three-quarters of their earnings, in other words, more than three times as much of their earnings came from the public programs as the commercial business. And the public programs are dealing with the sickest, most difficult people, and yet they're making most of the earnings on them. And there was a Strib editorial a month ago or so that talks about in 2010, Minnesota's average operating margin was 8.9%. Michigan, it was 2.4%. Wisconsin, 2.6%. And the executive director of Michigan Health Plans Association said the margins are necessary to ensure financial viability, but he says of Minnesota's 8.9% average margin in 2010, he said, I'm just surprised anyone would have that high a margin in the Medicaid area. Quite frankly, even in the commercial area, that would be a high margin. And my whole point is that there's a lot of money here, even with a small margin. We're talking large amounts of money, and that's why I think getting back to the bill, I think once in 25 years getting a thorough, independent, neutral audit with somebody who's not contracting with the health plans or anybody else, but a totally neutral audit, I think, is well overdue.
Thank you, Senator Marty. I do want to give Mr. Bartsch an opportunity to address the information you just cited. Mr. Bartsch.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you can look at an individual health plan or the industry as a whole on any given year, compare it to another year, and you will see that in some years some plans make money on commercial, some plans lose money on commercial, and some years some plans make money on Medicaid, some plans lose money on Medicaid. Senator Marty referenced 2010. That's a year, for example, where Medica, our earnings for our commercial business were higher than our earnings for our Medicaid business. We certainly have had years where our earnings for our Medicaid business have been higher than our earnings for our commercial business. When you look at any one snapshot in time, you can look at that snapshot in time, but I don't know that it's accurate to draw long-term conclusions from that.
Is there any, over some period of time, is there any general characterization you would make about the plans as a whole with respect to this issue? Are they, is the margin out of line generally over, I agree that there's year-to-year fluctuations, but if you look at it over a period of time, what does that suggest?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I think over a 10-year period, the margin for the industry as a whole over that 10-year period of time for the state's public programs is about 1.6%. It's under 2%.
Thank you. Are there questions for the witness? Well, thank you. Stay tuned if we have other questions. Senator Nino, I want to get back to your bill. I do have an amendment that I'd like to offer to your bill if you're inclined to take it. Actually, a couple of things I think might be useful. I do want to ask you a little bit about the bill's description of independent third-party audit. And I think amendment. Addresses that. Other than the time frame that you put in the amendment that says that they couldn't have provided audit service to a plan for the past 3 years, would the auditors that exist in Minnesota today qualify under this amendment?
Mr. Chair, the CPAs came to me this morning and indicated that the language that was in the bill previously probably would preclude anybody in Minnesota, but this with this recommended language, minus the three-year look-back, with this recommended language, they thought that would solve that problem.
Would this preclude anybody who had been involved in auditing a plan in the last 3 years from providing the next audit? In other words, there are several public audit firms that conduct the audits today. I don't think the plans are all audited by the same company, but would they, if a particular audit firm, say Deloitte or something, had audited Medica, would they next year be able to audit Blue Cross? Or I'm just making things up here, but or does this amendment preclude that and say that they couldn't do that at all?
Mr. Chair, I think it would depend on who their client was and to whom they would be providing those services. For example, if they contracted with the state of Minnesota to audit one of the Medica, they're not providing services to Medica. They're providing services to the state of Minnesota. If they were indeed providing those, in other words, if Medica was their client, this would preclude them, and that is the point, to make sure that we maintain that arm's length distance.
So is the idea that the plans themselves would not be contracting for their audits as they're doing right now, and that function would be assumed by the state?
Mr. Chair, this is an audit that is, yes, they'd be performing this service for the state.
So the audits that the plans currently do, they would still continue to do. And then in addition, the state would contract with somebody else to do another audit in addition to the one that the plans do. Is that what this is asking for.
Mr. Chair, unless the bill changes, and I've been in discussion with representatives from the plans about what, if any, of the current reporting and auditing and et cetera that they do, if we were to implement legislation of this sort, what would be redundant in to be able to, could they identify those items so that we could eliminate non-value-added efforts that so that we're not duplicating anything. So if this, we'll call it the no-holds-barred audit, is able to give us information that we're asking for somewhere else, we don't need to have them do that twice. And so far, I didn't have a list provided to me, but I've asked for that. And absolutely, to the extent that we can identify some of those, I think we should eliminate them because it would become non-value added. It would just be going through the motions and taking up time and probably a little bit of money.
The other question I want to ask you on the amendment language, paragraph M, the cost, because we do have a fiscal note, and we may need some clarification on this, but I've in the interim had a few people suggest to me that this cost would be accounted for as an administrative cost in the plan's accounting and would likely be paid out of Medicaid funds. And so is that your understanding of how that would be done?
Mr. Chair, I'm a little unclear as to the exact question. Could you restate
that? In your amendment that we adopted earlier, the A1 amendment, the paragraph M talks about the cost of this audit that we're talking about would be assessed by the commissioner against the managed care and the county-based purchasing plans being audited. But my understanding is, and I could be wrong and maybe someone can correct me, but from what I'd been told is that cost would be included as part of the administrative cost of the plan, that whatever the commissioner billed the plan, you know, whatever it might cost, and I'm not sure what this would be. Maybe somebody is here who could give us some idea what it costs to do one of these things, but I've heard at least several $100,000 would be a cost that would become a part of the administrative cost of the plan, and that the payment of that cost would come from Medicaid funds instead of being used for services to provide care, that the Medicaid dollars would be used to pay for the cost of the audit.
Mr. Chair, as to what line item that might be in the accounting, I suppose it probably would be counted as overhead, administrative costs, et cetera. Would that be eligible for matching funds as an expense as a result because it would be a legitimate expense, business operation expense, if you will, for the plan? Yes, it would be eligible for matching funds. To the extent that a dollar can only be spent once, if we spend a dollar on this, could we spend it on something else, e.g. healthcare services? Well, clearly you can't.
So, and going back to the original bill, paragraph K that talks about the contract with the third-party auditing firm shall be designed and administered to render that eligible for a federal subsidy. Is that what you're getting at, is that the cost of this would be offset by an additional federal subsidy to pay for the audit? Is that kind of what that's how that works?
Mr. Chair, that language is in there. My understanding is that CMS does have funding sources available where they can provide grants. Maybe that's not the right term, but they have money available that they can award for various efforts to make improvements. To the extent that this potentially could qualify, we wanted to put that language in there so that is a possibility. Again, Mr. Chair, going back to your point that you only spend a dollar once, to the extent that CMS would be willing to provide us some money out of their existing funding, we're certainly willing to take it.
Well, I'd like to perhaps offer an amendment here to your bill, and I'd like to offer the A2 amendment. And I think we've had a good discussion about the cost of this program. It is complex. It is complicated. I think it is a good thing for us to try to find a way to get more information, make that more available to the public. I do have had concerns about making sure that we're not asking for more data than what we currently ask, I guess. I think that's maybe sufficient. I have some concerns about making sure that data is dealt with in the proper way. But what I've thought, given some of the comments that we've had, particularly from some of the providers, that what this amendment does, and it's a, it takes a long time to say this, but the first subdivision is kind of a purpose statement that we typically don't do a lot of in the Senate, but just sort of restating the desire that we all have to make sure that we're providing information, making it available. The second subdivision is talking about the healthcare information, and this is really just a restatement of the information that we already asked them to provide. And I can be corrected on that if the plans disagree, but I think we tried to capture that. Thinking, I hope I have the right amendment here. I guess paragraph B of subdivision 2 is restating what the health plans provide. Paragraph C is for the healthcare delivery systems participating in the pilots would be asked to provide the same kind of information. Paragraph D on page 2 would require that clinics that include providers shall also provide information. And paragraph E is hospitals that I believe already provide this information. And F is the health plan companies, county-based purchasing plans, healthcare delivery systems. All would be required to provide this information at the same date. So the idea here, Senator Nienau, would be to get a complete look at where the Medicaid dollars are going by asking all the providers, the hospitals currently do, the plans certainly do, but to provide similar information at the same time so that the commissioner, if you look on paragraph G on page 3, would produce a report that would be able to collect all the information from all the sources and provide an opportunity for that to be analyzed so that we can understand, to the point that the providers have been making about where does the money go, are providers being paid appropriately, are there, where does it flow? And I think that to get a handle on that, it seems to me that we need to make sure that we're collecting similar kinds of reporting data from the whole spectrum of people who are participating in the program. What? Any thought on this as an approach?
Mr. Chair, it's 2.5 pages, so I'm still trying to read through all the detail. I don't know if anyone has any comments, pro or con. If they do, now would be good so I can read this. My initial reaction, Mr. Chair, is I believe, if I'm reading this correctly, is it's in addition to what currently is in the legislation, and we're creating a website, I believe, and the commissioner's going to report some information. My initial reaction isn't negative, but I would like a chance, if anyone wants to comment on it, give me a chance to read it, I'd appreciate that.
I'm not seeing anybody raising their hand that wants to comment, but since it's my amendment, I'll tell you what I was trying to accomplish here, sir, is that the bill that you have is really focused on the plans and trying to get data from the plans, which we do require them to submit. But I think the questions that have been asked and the questions about where the money flows, it seemed to me that if we could have an opportunity to collect similar kinds of information from the whole array of people who are receiving the state dollars, from the plans to the hospitals to the providers to the clinics all the way through, that they would have the same obligation to provide this data to give the department an opportunity to report on that, to answer the questions that have been raised today centering on why are the reimbursement rates the way they are. And the suggestion by some of the provider groups was that this reimbursement rate is flawed or the process is flawed and the money ends up with the plans. And I think to get at that, it would be, in my opinion, I thought it would be good to say, well, let's get a broader scope here and require the data to come from all the places where the money is going. And then that would give us an opportunity to just have a better assessment. Would not change the reporting requirements for the hospitals or the plans. They do that right now. It would just make the, I think the hospitals have a different reporting date. We'd ask them all to submit the information at the same time so that there could be an opportunity to get that. But it does require the department to do some exposure. It calls for a website that would post the most recent 3 years of data and try to do it in a way that would be more accessible to the public. But I think to get at the questions that are being raised here, it seems to me that we should take a broad look at this. Senator Hayden?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had one question. I was talking with my colleague, Senator Fischbach, and we finally figured out kind of what you want to do here. The question I have, I'm trying to figure it out, is it's almost like you're trying to, you want it to be apples to apples. You want to see it all the way through. So the question is, does the amendment make, I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, does the amendment make sure that you're asking for the data at the same time? Are we looking at the same period of time in which we're looking at the data? So in other words, to ensure that it lines up, if we're going to look at 2012, it looks at all of 2012 across, not someone's giving you half of 2011 and a piece of 2012 and then the others go prorated. I mean, sometimes these systems are complex in the way that they don't report apples to apples. So I want to ensure that this amendment does that, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hayden, that's a good question. My understanding is that the amendment does do that. That was my intent, to try to make sure that that all the data that we collect on where the money goes throughout the system, that we're looking at the same time period and applying the same kinds of requirements, so that when we are producing a report or an analysis of the data, we do have apples to apples. That's my intent, and I hope we've constructed that correctly, but that's the intent of the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had a note passed to me here. Apparently, Mr. Lehman had wanted to testify. I don't know if he wants to speak specifically to this amendment, but he just wanted to make sure that he got a chance to speak. If he wants to speak to this, I guess now would be a good time. And Mr. Feinwax was wanting to make a comment.
Okay. If Mr. Lehman is here, would he be fine? Is this to the amendment or just generally?
Just in general. But I do have one comment on the amendment as well.
Well, so. Please.
I'm multifaceted, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be very brief. I'm testifying this evening on behalf of the Minnesota Association of County Health Plans. Those are the three county-based purchasing organizations. You'll see throughout the bill, it references, managed care plans or county-based purchasing. We've heard a lot about HMOs and managed care plans so far in this hearing, but we haven't heard much about county-based purchasing plans. This is Prime West, South Country Health Alliance, and Itasca Medical Care in Senator Newman's district, Senator Lori's district, and a lot of other districts. I just want to be clear for the committee and members, Minnesota's county-based purchasing plans support transparency. Our board meetings are open to the public. Our boards are comprised of elected county commissioners accountable back to the voters who elected them. We think our financial operations are very transparent, and I think an example of that or evidence of that is the lack of concern you've heard so far in this hearing about county-based purchasing transparency. We've heard a lot about transparency for others. We haven't heard any concerns raised about county-based purchasing. We think that Senator Nienau's bill is raising the right questions and that it's moving in the right direction. We have some suggestions about how it could be improved. Specifically, just to give you a few examples, Mr. Barsh talked about the reserves of Medicaid and Medicare and commercial products, both group and individual, and how all those reserves are looked at. We think it would be helpful to have audits cover both commercial and public programs instead of just public programs. We think it would be useful to look at consolidation and coordination of all government audits. Again, as Mr. Barsh raised this morning, there are Commerce Department audits, Health Department audits, Human Service Department audits, CMS federal audits. I think it would be useful if we're concerned about the use of public dollars, to look at what are the questions we want to ask. What is the one audit that could address those concerns and not have duplicative audits? The last thing I would mention as an example to improve the bill is to eliminate duplicative, excessive, or unnecessary reports. I think in the past you've heard that the HMOs and the county-based purchasing plans have over 1,100 reports a year that they must file with Health, Commerce, DHS, or the federal government. We believe many of those reports are duplicative. The form might be green for one agency and blue for another. They might ask the questions in one order in one agency, the reverse order. But we think it'd be appropriate to look at all those reports and how they can be reduced. To your amendment, Mr. Chairman, I haven't had time to look at it, but I would just mention, in just looking at it, in light of we currently have to do 1,100 reports a year, here's some more things we have to do. I know at the end you mentioned, the amendment mentions, reviewing all reporting and auditing requirements for the entities and recommending repeal. Yes, let's do that as quickly as possible so that we not end the session with 1,100 reports and required reports and audits, plus more reports from this amendment and more reports from others. But in conclusion, Mr. Chairman, we support transparency. We think the bill is moving in the right direction. We've shared some suggestions with Senator Nee now, and as things progress, should they progress, we hope to see some of those suggestions added to the bill as it goes forward.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Are there any questions for the witness? Thank you, Mr. Lehman.
Thank you.
And Senator Nino, you had some testimony that on the amendment, is that?
Mr. Feinwachs had asked if he could address the amendment.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, members, good evening. My name is David Feinwachs. I reside in the city of St. Paul. As to the amendment, Mr. Chairman, members, the amendment, I think, tries to consolidate the sort of one-stop shopping notion and website analysis or protocol that was started last year. And to the extent that we're doing that, that's probably a fine idea. Here's the concern I have. Most of the items articulated in the amendment for consolidation in a single place are collected now. And really, when you think about audits, there's two kinds of audits. There's audits where you fill out forms, and check boxes, and fill in the blanks and hand them in, and people check to make sure you hand it in the form and it's completely filled out. And there's audits to determine whether or not the information on the form is indeed correct and accurate. We got lots of the first kind of audit, very few of the second kind. Recently, we received a letter from Senator Grassley addressed to all the plans and to the state of Minnesota as well. And what we're looking for and what I think the amendment doesn't address is things that, like validating the claims information and the actuarial assumptions used to calculate the costs and the rates that are certified to the federal government. Because we're not looking here to guarantee providers any level of income. It's just that in the certification of our Medicaid program rates to the federal government, we make certain representations, or we're supposed to make certain representations, about what we're spending on health care and what it costs. And what needs to be checked here is the underlying assumptions and accuracy of those representations. None of that's going on now. None of that would be addressed by the amendment, and that would be the reason for the type of audits that are described in Senator Nienau's bill. And to the extent that they could somehow be blended in with this, that would be a fine idea, but they are lacking, in my estimation, in the proposed amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Feinwachs. I guess where we had some discussion earlier on the bill and on page 3 about auditable proof that the encounters and claims are occurring, the testimony that I thought we heard is that the audits that we do today do that. And so my thought was, given the concern that I think it's a justifiable concern, that we'd be able to try to find out and make sure we've got information that covers the entire scope of where the money is going, that my amendment would simply broaden the requirement of the transparency, the auditing, the collection of data to places where we're currently not collecting any data. We do collect data from the hospitals and from the county-based plans. I think what my amendment would contemplate is making that collection date be the same. I picked an arbitrary date. We could certainly adjust that if we needed to, but to try to get all the data to be reported on the same date, and then to ask the other parts of the healthcare delivery system that are receiving state money to also provide similar information to the department for analysis so that the entire picture of where the money is going can be understood. And I see we have Mary Krinke here who's perhaps wanting to make a comment. I'd like to give you a chance to do that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. Obviously, we haven't had a chance to thoroughly review this amendment, and I'm not really quite sure of all of the impact. I think that most of the provisions in here are indeed publicly reported already. I would like an opportunity to go back and to see if that is indeed the case. But I would like to just, there's a couple questions I do have on 2.19 through 2.24. Right now, hospitals report our bad debt, charity care, uncompensated care. It's based on costs, not charges. And this really is a very important distinction because we are really trying to think about this in terms of what are the actual costs to the hospital rather than what are they charging for those services. Also, there seems to be some conflict here with that you want us to report data that is no older than the previous fiscal year, but up above it says the most recent 3 years. So not really quite sure how that would work exactly either.
Well, it may be my fault in trying to write this. What I was suggesting is that the department would publish 3 years of data, but the reports would only cover 1 year. Yeah. That's what I intended to say in the amendment. Maybe that could be clarified.
Mr. Chairman, if it would be okay with you and the committee's wishes, we would certainly like the opportunity to go back and to see how this lines up with what we are currently already publicly reporting and see if the new requirements in this amendment do indeed line up with what we are already doing.
I'd appreciate that. And again, I tried to do my best to make sure that we were capturing the things you were already reporting. I do acknowledge that it asked for a different date to do those reports, and I'd be happy to work that out with you if you felt that that was something that needed to be adjusted. But if there are things in here that are not that we're asking for that are not currently being done, I'm happy to work with you on that. My intent was to not put additional burdens on what hospitals report, but to try to collect the data in the same time frame as we do for the provider or for the plans.
Mr. Chairman, if I could make one other comment. The information that we report on the HAR report has been audited, and so it is generally at least a year old. So it is not as timely as other information that we report because of the audit function. So I think that we could speed up the time, but then we may not have the audit function that we have now. So
okay. Well, if this amendment does go on the bill, I'd certainly be willing to work with you on changing it. I think because of the finance component, we probably are going to have to hold this for a bit to make sure we get it into whatever
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Format that we want it to do. But thank you for your comment. Sir Nino, any other thoughts on this? Are you willing to accept, I hope, a friendly amendment to your design here?
Well, Mr. Chair, it certainly does no harm to the bill. There's the potential that additional compilation of data. It sounds like you're just trying to get to data that exists right now and put it into a meaningful form, as best I can tell in reading through this, both in electronic format via website and a published report, which again could be electronic format or tangible format, depending on how the department chooses to do that. But I don't see this doing any harm to the bill as it was drafted. It's just kind of an extension and an offshoot.
Other questions on the amendment? Senator Lord.
Just reading through it, I'm wondering if you've talked at all with the agencies about what it might take for them to implement that. I mean, I don't know how much work that might be or if they might have thoughts, but, I mean, it would have some fiscal implications not currently addressed in the bill, and I don't know how extensive those might be. Have you had any indication?
Senator Lori, thanks for the question. I did talk briefly with the Department of Human Services today about this idea. I think there would probably be something, but we don't have a fiscal note, but I would certainly be willing to develop that if this were to go on the bill so that we could make sure we had a good chance of understanding what was involved in implementing it. So I'm not trying to ignore that. I just didn't have an opportunity to get that drafted up. Well, Senator, you know, if you're friendly, I'd like to move the A2 amendment. Other questions on the amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion passes. Senator Nino, if you'll bear with me, I have a couple other things I'd like to run by you. I'd like to look at the A5 amendment. And this is a, I think it's something that we took a little bit of a shot at last year in the course of our bills that had to do with the plans and how we do this. It simply is a repealing of the, I think it's called the 101 provision in the statute that requires the plans to bid on the state business. And this is simply a repealer of that requirement. The reason I wanted to introduce this, it was similar to what we talked about last year when we had this provision, was to try to make sure that the contract relationship that we have with the plans in the state is an arm's length relationship. That it seems to me that if you have an obligation as a plan, as a condition of licensure, to submit a bid in good faith, it seems to me that you've got a contractual relationship that isn't necessarily one that offers a fair negotiation. I think you need to give people an opportunity to say no if they think this isn't the right way to do this. And I do think some of the things that are being raised as questions, in my opinion, could be related to the fact that there may not be that arm's length relationship. So it's not directly related to your bill, but it was close enough that I thought if you were willing to incorporate this into the language of the bill, I think that it would help the overall structure of how we administer the PMAP programs. And so I don't know if you have any comments.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm very sympathetic to the efforts in your bill, although I'm hesitant to put things into the bill that's going to make it a target for a veto. The department was up here previously saying that they're okay with it. I don't know what they might think about this. I'd be interested to hear.
Well, and certainly we can invite them to come up and comment. I did run this by them briefly earlier today. I think that they may be open to contemplating that. I'm not sure. Maybe if there's someone from the department would like to comment,
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Scott Leitz with the Department of Human Services. Mr. Chair, as I read the amendment, it would repeal the requirement that health maintenance organizations submit a good faith bid as part of the process. And I would say, just a couple of comments, Mr. Chair. The first, I think, would be that just historically, the reason that Rule 101 was in place was really to ensure that statewide we had access to services for people who were enrolling in health plans. And one of the reasons historically we went the route of enrolling individuals to managed care was because managed care plans had constructed networks of providers statewide so that we had statewide coverage to be able to make sure our clients receive services. We haven't seen some of the issues that other states have seen around access to services for individuals. And it's particularly acute in the rural areas where there are fewer providers. And some states have had trouble finding if they're directly contracting with those providers to participate. As has been mentioned, as the commissioner mentioned, we are changing the way that we do the work with regards to our contracting, but we're on sort of the front end of that. We've made a lot of progress on it, but to date we've competitively bid 7 of the 87 counties, although we do intend to do more into the future. I think the concern that we would have, and I think we're open to looking at this moving forward, would simply be we don't know what the impact of this would be at this point in time. We're not opposed to, as we roll forward with those reforms, really looking more holistically at does this rule make sense in the context of the direction that we're going? I think the concern that we have at this point in time is simply that we don't know the answer to that at this point.
Okay. I appreciate it. Thank you. I guess one thing I thought of that, again, going back to some of the testimony we heard today, that this may be another way to get at the reimbursement question. If plans are trying to negotiate a contract that they feel they can't execute, but I mean, it may be a way to bring some attention to that issue. And so, but I do think that it, from my perspective, it makes sense to at least offer an opportunity for this to be a little bit more of an arm's length relationship. So I think we have somebody else who wants to testify.
Mr. Chair and members, Dave Renner with the Minnesota Medical Association. As I read this, first I just want to point out that Rule 101, which is the requirement that we participate, does not just apply to health plans. Current law also requires all providers to participate in these programs. And in addition, there is, under what's called our contract stacking laws, a requirement that if a provider wants to participate in a private health plan, they also have to take whatever the plan offers on the public side. So to address your last comment, trying to put some pressure on the payment rates, we think by repealing Rule 101 only for the health plans will do the opposite of that. Because now we're going to competitive bidding. The health plans can submit potentially a low bid. And then because they still have the hammer, in a sense, over the provider's head and require us to participate in their products, we have no ability to negotiate those rates or to have any kind of discussions about what those payment rates should be. So if we want to repeal Rule 101, we would encourage you to repeal entire Rule 101, which applies to both health plans and providers. And we would also request that you amend our contract stacking laws to no longer require us to participate in public programs in order to be a part of their health plan's private networks.
Thank you. Senator Hayden, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, Mr. Renner's testimony kind of brings me to it brings me to the place that thinks that this issue, this amendment that you've offered, is really a bill. It's really something that if you wanted to offer, we should take the committee's time. We should, you know, really sit down and thoroughly go through all of the implications that this would have. And I think Mr. Renner and others in the department are kind of wisely saying that, you know, this bill that we have today is really about a third party, you know, forensic audit, making sure that, you know, we can see kind of where our dollars are going. And I think that that is important. But to add this amendment onto this bill, I think, would be unfortunate because of what is the potential unforeseen consequences of this. And so I think that every single person here who does this work could probably get up and give you another reason or another ramification of something that is as vast as this particular amendment. So though I appreciate your being creative, Mr. Chair, of trying to get at some of this work, but it appears to me that this is something that we should probably use the committee's time to really sit down and thoroughly go through all of the various issues that would come if we start to fundamentally change the way in which we do business around here with the plans.
Okay. Senator Dinow, any additional thoughts?
Mr. Chair, I'm somewhat ambivalent on it. I'm, on one hand, I open my comments. I'm sympathetic to the effort here. I'm inclined to agree that we could just get it stricken across the board. But on the other hand, I get concerned about bogging down a bill. So, Mr. Chair, I guess give my personal preference would be I'd like to see the bill move without it, but whatever the committee's will, I'm not adamantly opposed to it conceptually. I just get concerned about procedurally what's this going to mean and what does it mean with the governor and the administration and what does it mean with other members, et cetera.
Mr. Barsh, were you looking at make a comment on this amendment?
So let's.
Mr. Chairman and members, again, for the record, my name is Jeff Barsh, here on behalf of Medica and the Council of Health Plans. Very quickly, I just wanted to testify in support of the amendment. I hadn't planned to testify, but wanted to raise a couple issues that were addressed by other testifiers. The first is the issue of Rule 101, or the requirement to participate in state public programs, and how that differs for HMOs versus providers. Mr. Renner's correct. Providers are required to participate in state public programs if they wish to participate and serve state employees. That's a very different requirement than the one on HMOs, which is you need to participate in state public programs or you cannot be licensed to do business in the state. So I need to state that clarification because they are very two distinct requirements in terms of what is on the HMOs versus what is on the providers. The other issue I'd like to address is Mr. Leitz talked about the movement towards competitive bidding and the department's rolling out of new demonstration projects. I think this is an appropriate question to ask as we move through that process. As the competitive bid process went through in the seven-county metro area, I would say I don't know that it really truly was a competitive bid, in part because the department knew we had to submit a bid. And so during that process, we had questions regarding how the bid was potentially to be submitted or the clientele we were potentially bidding on. We didn't always get the answers to those questions, and it wasn't that the department was trying to withhold information. I think that speed became an issue. But it goes to the point as the state moves forward with their new ways of purchasing health care across the state, I don't know that it's going to be a fair process for us if we're not going to be able to get the full level of information in order to bid appropriately for those services. And I think removing, Mr. Chairman, as you described it, maybe that blurred line between where the state ends and the private sector begins would help make that competitive bidding process more competitive as we rolled it out, not just as the HMOs bid with the state, but also potentially for others.
Thank you. Are there questions for the witness? Senator Nino, I guess I'd like to encourage you to contemplate allowing the amendment to go on your bill. I think I do think it would help create a better structure. I appreciate the comments about the broader 101, and I'm not opposed to considering those things, but I'm looking at your bill as one of trying to address a sort of HMO structure situation and the data, and I just thought that this might be another way to try to get at a better structure that might yield more transparency going forward to create some distance between the department and the plans. And so that's my reason for it. If you're willing to take a vote, I'll offer the amendment. If you're absolutely opposed to it, I don't want to. Senator Lurie has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's really a question for you, I guess, as it's your amendment. But this is a really fundamental change to how we do business. I mean, Senator Nienau's bill is really about transparency and auditing, just taking a look at what we do, not fundamentally changing it. And we've had all of, 7 or 8 minutes to think about this. This really is a pretty big deal, and it's much broader in scope. I mean, I would almost question the germaneness. I'm not going to challenge it, but it really is getting to another whole broad issue that I really would like to dig into a little deeper before being pushed to vote on it, truthfully. I mean, I think you make a lot of valid points, but I think there's many more questions than answers tonight in this late hour and short time frame that members and constituencies have had to process this. So, I mean, I think if it comes to a vote, I'm probably not going to support this today, but I would support the concept of continuing this conversation and determining if this is a good direction. But the bill we have is just really about transparency and taking a look at what we do, not fundamentally changing it.
Okay. Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Remind me, didn't we have a full hearing on this, your amendment, last year in bill form? It seemed like we had quite a long hearing, actually. Is my memory failing me?
Senator Hoffman, no. We did have, this was a provision that I resurrected from, I think I can't remember which bill, or if we, I think it was an amendment to a bill, but we did have a fairly lengthy hearing on this, and some of the same discussion was had at that point. And I, you know, Senator Lori's comments, I understand that you're right, it is a significant change, but I think it's a change that, in my opinion, would help the competitive process. And as the commissioner testified, I think we all acknowledge that there's some benefit from that. I'm just concerned that given the discussion we're having about transparency and making sure that we're doing things that are appropriate, to try to at least create the opportunity for plans to decline if they feel it isn't the right way to do things, that to create that, I think, would be a good thing. Now, I don't know if the plans would come up and say they would walk away from state business. Maybe they would under certain circumstances. I don't know. But I think that just trying to create that opportunity, in my opinion, would be a way to create conditions that would allow for greater clarity. Senator Lori.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I try to be a good member, attend most meetings. I don't recall any discussion about this. There were many discussions that I was not at last year. I mean, maybe that was one of those. A conference committee that had no DFL members on it, very little public. I don't know. I don't recall having extensive conversations on this provision last year, and I've worked very hard to keep up to date on what's going to come before our body. So, I mean, I don't want to say that this is, you know, a non-starter or anything, but we do owe it more conversation than we've had, and I certainly don't recall an extensive conversation about it last year in committee.
Okay. Are there other questions? Senator Nino, what's your thought?
Mr. Chair,
leave it up to the committee?
Whatever the will of the committee is.
All right. Well, then I will leave it up to the will of the committee, and we've heard some discussion, pro and con, so I will offer the A5 amendment to that amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
I believe, in my judgment, the ayes have it, so we'll put that on the bill. And Senator Nino, just indulge me a couple of quick other additions. I want to ask you to take a look at the A6 amendment. And while that's being passed out, what this is this was actually something that was in our bill last year that talks about a study of for-profit HMOs. I think this may be, and Council can correct me, the identical language that we did have in the bill that didn't make it all the way through the process. But this is simply asking for the commissioner contract with an entity in health economics and healthcare delivery, and to just study the feasibility of allowing for-profit HMOs to do business in Minnesota. So that's the amendment. And again, I think it is related to what the objective here is, which is asking questions about the HMO structure and whether this. I think just studying the for-profit versus not-for-profit, I think that might be worth at least taking a look at in the context of transparency and accountability. Senator Hayden.
I guess since we're kind of going through this process, I got the very same comments to you, sir. These are very provocative issues. We have a president in the state that says that we have not-for-profit HMOs. There was a long discussion to get us to that point. I imagine if we wanted to change that, I wouldn't find this as an amendment to a transparency bill, but that this would be a bill that the chair would bring, sit down and fill the gallery up and have a very robust discussion, not at 7:30 on deadline week. Frankly, Mr. Chair, that this would be something that we would sit down and we would have a great debate. And if it was, and we'd hear the pros and cons, and we do all the work that we do around here, we'd have the departments here, we'd have all the experts, we'd have citizens, and we would talk about kind of why our system is like it is and if we should have a better system. And so, you know, Mr. Chair, with all due respect, I I know that these are some of the things that you hope that we could do, but, you know, we've been here, I guess, 7 weeks now, kind of riding and walking through these issues. And so I just think that now's not the time. If we wanted to have a fundamental change to the way in which we deliver our health care system or the way our HMOs are set up, we should have started this on day one, and we should have had a robust discussion at that point. And the implications, I think, are great. And I wonder if it should, you know, leave here and then we'll go to Commerce and look at the insurance. I don't know that. You know, I don't know what the path would be for this, but that's kind of my point. We don't know that. And so I guess with that, Mr. Chair, you know, you're offering it, and it's your pleasure, but I just think that this is not the time to offer these, especially on a bill that really, I think, you know, Senator Nenow has brought in really good faith to kind of look at this issue of transparency. I think if we're going to start to stick on, you know, really big issues, we should really take the proper time to do so.
And Senator Hayden, I don't disagree at all that we need to have a full hearing and discussion about the for-profit, not-for-profit. I would anticipate that we could do that January 15th, 2013. What I'm really asking for is for the department to go and do some preparatory work on this issue, bring it back to the legislature in the form of a study findings that we can then bring this up and talk about the policy change. I'm not advocating for a policy change here. I'm just asking that we ask the department to take a look at, create a study that we can use for a discussion, I hope, next year. Senator Lori.
Mr. Chair, on the mechanics of this, I see that they're going to contract with an entity instead of doing it themselves. Is there some reason for a contract? And then also the health department is one of three that kind of oversee. I mean, really, insurance is more Commerce, and DHS is the entity that oversees these programs. I mean, health is an interesting lead, but then it's also contracted out. I'm just inquiring about the mechanics and your thought processes and why that route was chosen.
Senator Lori, just to try to get an independent assessment rather than I know, as Senator Hayden has pointed out, that we've kind of had a not-for-profit structure in Minnesota. That's been a tradition, and it seemed to me that if we had some outside independent entity to perform the study, that we'd at least get something a little bit more independent of perhaps what our biases may show us right now. Yes, Senator Lori.
Well, I mean, if the Department of Health goes and buys a study, I don't know how effective it is at eliminating the bias that might that might be perceived there or not. I don't know what, you know, I mean, maybe you should just tell them to do a study and say that they could contract, or so I don't know. I mean, it's all right, whatever. I don't know. Loading this up.
Oh, sorry.
Senator Nenow, any thoughts on doing a study?
Mr. Chair, similar to the last amendment, and I don't want to load up a bill and put a veto target on it. I'd be interested to hear what the department thinks of this. I know we passed this last year. I do not recall what cost was associated with that. I don't know if we have that information, if any of our fiscal staff or if you, Mr. Chair, recall.
I don't recall. It may be in part of the fiscal note on one of the bills we had last year, but I don't know that off the top of my head. I don't know if our fiscal analyst can recall that either. I'm not going to ask him to. He's advising me about 50. I think he means 50,000, not $50. But am I correct? Is that okay?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Altman.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I have a whole collection of things. First of all, I'm concerned that you in the chair are offering amendments. That is not something we do in the Senate. You usually give the gavel aside to another member and then offer the amendments. Just as a reminder that that's the tradition in the Senate. Second thing, on line 9, I think we have medical assistance, not medial assistance. And then on line 16, after the word taxes, we should delete the comma and the word which and insert that. And that's just a good grammar thing.
Thank you, Senator Higgins. And if this amendment goes forward, we'll incorporate your appropriate corrections to the grammar and spelling. Thank you. Senator Hayden.
So, you know, once again, and I recognize, as my colleague has shown me, it's just a study, but I think my comments still stand, though, that this is where we're asking our fiscal folks to recall from memory from an omnibus bill last year about how much it might cost. We are even as a study, this still should be something that we have a pretty good discussion about. And so I still will say that I think that these are good ideas to at least discuss. I don't know if I'd support them or not, but I don't think that now would be the time to attach those to a bill that I think was, you know, something that I was really contemplating supporting because of its kind of pretty clear understanding of what it was trying to do. And so, you know, you have the ability to call us in and set the agenda. And so I would almost say that this would be an opportunity for these amendments for you to, you know, schedule a time for us, even this week yet, to sit down and talk about kind of what this means and make sure that our staff can go and do the research to figure out what the cost is. You know, today in the session, we kind of had a long discussion about this, frankly. Senator Lori talked about kind of, you know, things kind of arriving and hitting the floor and we not really having the robust discussion and understand what they mean in the committee room when we're supposed to do the work, and then we're kind of in the middle of session trying to debate this and trying to figure this out without the opportunity of everybody weighing in. And so, once again, sir, I would ask that we find some time this week if these are important for you to put these forward, but I don't think this is the time on Senator Enow's bill.
Senator Hayden, just let me, I think that there is likely some cost to do a study. I'm not asking our fiscal analyst to give us a precise number on that, but because the bill has a fiscal note that it is, we're going to have to lay this over and get the whole thing analyzed, and we will do that before we would move it on. So I'm not asking to move this out of committee until we know what those costs are, and if it turns out to be something that is unworkable, we can take the provisions that are unworkable out. I'm not trying to say that I would like to move the bill and move it forward, but I just thought it would be, I thought these things, in my judgment, as I looked at the bill and trying to answer some of the larger questions that are being raised by the bill, which is really the structure that we have, the HMO structure, is it really working the way that we want it to? And it's, as I've heard the testimony and read through it and had conversations, it's not just about the audits, it's not just about the payments. It seems to be there are large questions being asked about the whole thing. And so that was really the reason why I thought, well, this would be an opportunity in that context to offer a study to be done to help us as we go forward to answer those questions. But I'm not trying to push this out of committee until we know what those costs might be, and I certainly would do that before we'd move it out. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just wanted to speak in support of at least looking at for-profit health maintenance organizations in the sense that if we increase competition, it generally shrinks margins. And if our big concern here is that the plans are keeping more than they should, then competition's probably an okay thing. Because the more people you have going after a book of business, the tighter their margins are going to be, and the harder they're going to work to stay profitable and provide the services. But they're going to have less wiggle room.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments. I share your views. But again, I want to emphasize this is not implementing the policy change of having for-profit HMOs, but I would like to at least ask for a study to be done. But, Senator Nino, again, I'll leave it up to your call if you want to leave it to the will of the committee or if you're just opposed or what's your sense?
Mr. Chair, I'm curious if the department has any comment.
Well, we can ask anybody from the department want to make a comment about, I guess we don't know if we have the health, we're asking the health department to do this. There's probably not anybody here, or maybe there is.
Hello, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Matthew Colley, and I'm the legislative liaison with the Department of Health. I do not know of particulars of this particular amendment, so I don't have a comment on it, but I wanted to point out that we are here.
Okay. Well, basically, we're just asking the department to contract to do a study, and I appreciate that you may not be familiar with it, but at this point, would you be opposed to at least contemplating that, or...
I can definitely take it back to the department, okay, and we can look at it for you.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Should we offer it, or, Senator Nienau, I'm going to leave it up to you.
Well, Mr. Chair, given my druthers, I'd keep the bill thinner than thicker and not complicate the question with somewhat related issues, but if you or someone else on the committee offers the amendment, then whatever the will of the committee might be will be the will of the committee.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, does Senator Nienau's bill need to go to finance without this?
Oh, yeah.
Senator Higgins, yes. The okay. original bill had a fiscal note of about slightly under $1 million. And,
oh, yes, I remember now.
And so
okay, sorry.
I'm not trying to... You know, put a fiscal note on a bill that doesn't have a fiscal note. We do have some fiscal issues, and I'm willing to certainly get these things analyzed by the fiscal people. And before we would move it, we'd have a clear sense of what is entailed. And at that point, there seems to be things that we need to adjust, we'll do that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the A6 amendment, even though my past memory. I recall that the chair of the Budget Committee moved a lot of amendments in her days, so I would like to move the A6.
Thank you, Senator Rosen. I appreciate that. My recollection is there are other committees that I did see that practice, although I think, Senator Higgins, you're probably right that most of the time that didn't happen. But thank you, Senator Rosen. I appreciate
it. In that other body.
In that other body. All right. Senator Rosen moves the A6 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. And Senator Nienau, one last one. And this one is the A7 amendment. And this calls for another study. And this one we are asking the Commissioner of Human Services. And this is a study of managed care. And this, again, more centrally to the ideas that are being brought up in your bill, but asking them to... contract with an independent vendor that has expertise in evaluating Medicaid managed care programs to evaluate the value of managed care for our programs and list some things that that we want to have them look at: satisfaction of state public health care program recipients, providers, ability to measure improve outcomes, access to health services, availability of additional services, actual and potential cost savings to the state, level of alignment with state and federal health care reform policies, including so just again asking for to the larger theme of your bill that we get some outside independent assessment of managed care. And I'll be honest with you, I'm not necessarily a huge fan of managed care as an idea, but I think that having this might be helpful as the legislature is contemplating going forward how we're going to do these things, and it certainly might provide some information that would be useful in addressing some of the questions and concerns that were raised by testifiers earlier in the hearing. Any thoughts on this one?
I'm reading it, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to read and listen at the same time.
And this is, I promise, my last one. So.
Mr. Chair, while he's thinking.
Senator Higgins.
I have a question on figuring out, I'm trying to figure out how this independent vendor with expertise in evaluating managed care will assess the satisfaction of the recipients and the providers. How do you envision a survey of all of those folks? I mean, this could really get in the weeds. The next one is the ability to measure and improve health outcomes. You know, that very much depends on who the recipients are and what their health issues are. The alignment with federal and state health reform policies could get you a really long report that would be really expensive. And I think the fiscal note on this could be a real humdinger, actually.
Well, Senator Higgins, I hope it isn't, but I would ask for a fiscal note to assess this and see what the cost might be. And I know that there's been some desire to try to do some things involving some expenditure of dollars this year. I think many of us would like to see something done. We're looking at something fairly modest, I hope. And so if something like this were to be overly costly, then I think it would have to be considered about whether it's worth the value to do it. But I think to try to have a way to ask some of these broader questions, to have some independent look at how we do this in Minnesota compared to other options that may exist, I think that would be of value to the legislature next year or going forward in looking at how we may want to change some things or do things differently. So
Mr. Chair, back Senator on the question of the measuring the satisfaction of the recipients and the providers, what did you have in mind there?
Senator Higgins, I'm not one of these people that's expert in doing this kind of work, so I'm not sure if my opinion is adequate. But I do know that there are ways that businesses try to measure how well they do what they do. And I guess I'm not trying to define how to do that work. I guess what I believe is that there are people that do evaluations and can that there are techniques available to do them, but I'm not expert to tell you what they would be.
So. Well, Mr. Chair, I think in putting together the fiscal note, somebody's going to have to put some parameters on that. Because otherwise, you know, it could be let's survey one of every 9,000 recipients, or let's survey every recipient. You know, there's a huge difference in cost in that, and so you might want to be thinking about that. Because somebody who's doing the fiscal note will really struggle with that unless there's some parameters given to them.
Well, maybe it'd be good to ask the fiscal note people to take a look at it and see what they come up with. And if it seems to be unworkable, we can either adjust it or do away with it altogether. Is someone from the department here that would want to comment on this? Thank you, Commissioner, for hanging around. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, if I may, I would say that the department supports this amendment. We think this is an excellent idea, and we'll try to come up with a fiscal note that there will be a fiscal note. We'll try and have one that's less than a humdinger.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm not sure if I have a definition of humdinger, but.
Okay.
Senator Lori.
Just in terms of the construction of it, again, you picked a different commissioner here, but still contracting with an independent vendor. And then this last sentence, the determination of the value of managed care must include, you know, a consideration of the following as compared to fee for service. I mean, is it Minnesota's specific managed care compared to what? Compared to fee for service just in general? Minnesota's experience with fee for service? Or I mean, if it's just managed care versus fee-for-service, I mean, there's hundreds of masters and doctoral theses out there and articles in scholarly magazines. I mean, what fee-for-service program are we comparing it to?
Maybe the language needs to be reworked a little bit. What I was trying to get at was as we look at managed care, is that the system that works best for Minnesota? I was assuming this was Minnesota. And I guess if you're talking about public programs, in my opinion, there's really only two ways to do it. Either you contract with a private entity like a plan, or you do it directly through a fee-for-service structure. So that was kind of what I was trying to get at, is as we contemplate managed care, you've kind of got two basic ways to do it. Let's look at how we do it in Minnesota, get an analysis of whether what we're doing is effective or not, and compare it to what the alternative might be. And in the course of doing that, I'm hoping that we would uncover and learn some things about if we think managed care is the better way to do it, that we'd learn how to do it a little better. So,
I mean, that said,
Senator Lori.
And maybe I'll follow up and just say that, yeah, I mean, I kind of agree with the commissioner. I like the concept, but I do think it needs a little work on the construct.
And Senator Lori, I would invite you, if we're going to lay this over for a bit till we get the fiscal notes put together, and if you've got some additional or better language, I'm happy to add it to the language here, assuming we put this on the bill.
We talk frequently. I'll bend your ear about it as we go.
Thank you. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I don't have quite the memory that you have, Senator Hoffman, but I do remember not very long ago, I think it's related similarly to this, that we asked the HMOs to be an audit of the HMOs and to ask the auditor to take a look at their performance against a number of measures and what the original objectives were for those health maintenance organizations. It's not that long ago that we did just that through an auditor's process, and I think some of the questions that we asked at that time, or in here, were asked at that time, and that there is analysis done already. I hate to see us redoing something and then doing nothing with it. So I guess my question would be, did you take a look at that in preparing this and for a comparison in terms of what information already has been presented to us that would be new or be more helpful in relationship to this?
Are you talking about the legislative auditor's report?
Yes.
I did look at that. I guess my thought wasn't to do something that was duplicative, but really in the context of the issues being raised by Senator Nino's bill and trying to find a more comprehensive or more specific answer to some of those concerns that are being raised and to make sure that the structure that we have is adequate and that people have confidence in. I think there were questions raised, and the commissioner raised them, and I think Senator Nino has raised them, is do people have confidence in the structure that we have as being sound and effective? And I was hoping to at least put this on the table as a way to get at that, and that was my intent. Senator Scherer.
So if I were to reduce maybe to the point of being in error, what you're trying to accomplish with a number of these is to through studies or through analysis, focus on your belief system that you don't think this is the best structure, that you think it should be a for-profit system, that there is a lack of confidence in the existing system and that it in and of itself creates the problems that make it difficult for us to have oversight in terms of how public dollars are being spent.
Sir, sure, and my thought, and I do have my opinions, which we all have, but what I was really trying to do here was to put in place an opportunity for questions and study to be brought to this whole structure, because there are questions that have been asked, and there are people who are suggesting that this structure isn't producing the kind of at least financial results that some people think that we ought to have. So I think that is a question that is a little bit broader than just audits, because we do a lot of audits. But there are questions raised about the things that those audits produce. And so actually the series of amendments that I have offered, I was trying to think about, well, if we're really going to get after this question of how well does this sort of blended state HMO structure work, I thought we should try to put as many things on the table and ask for a more comprehensive look, and some of it is studies. I can't tell you what the studies will tell us, but I think that they will be helpful for the legislature in the future to take those things up and perhaps address some of the questions and bring about some improvement to the system. So I'm not going to say that my particular biases today are the things that would be in place, but I am hopeful that what we learn will help us all to move in a direction that is positive and that the public has greater confidence in. That's really, I think, the goal. Any other comments, questions? Senator Sherrod.
Thank you. I wouldn't want you to think, Mr. Chair, that I disagree that I think the kinds of discussions and conversations about how we structure and oversee the expenditures of the state for healthcare programs is critically important. We have an enormous responsibility to make certain that it's the people that are profiting from the expenditures and you know, unlike other free market advantages that can occur in business, healthcare is one that has not demonstrated that the more that we open it to free market, that it drives down the cost of healthcare. So, but I think that it's worth a discussion. It's an effort. And I think it should be a very lengthy, long-term, deliberate process, not something that should come up as an amendment on a bill that really relates to trying to get some exposure. I like the concept, but to actually the last two amendments are my favorite of the three. The first one is the most, I think, problematic. And I am very concerned about what I think is a pretty good bill here, Senator, that as we add more of this on, that we create higher probability of it not making it all the way to where we want it to go. And I just hate to see these major kinds of questions and considerations be thrown on a bill when it could have been put in a bill and could have been a whole discussion about how we study the potential reform for how we manage care and expenditure of state dollars in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. Well, Senator Nino, if you have no objection, I'd like to entertain that motion to adopt the amendment if anyone is willing to. Senator Rosen,
I'll move the A7 amendment, please.
Be willing to offer the A7 amendment. Thank you, Senator Rosen. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Thank you. The motion passes. Senator Nino, I don't have any more amendments to offer. You're probably happy to hear that. The committee's probably happy to hear that. I would like to hold the bill over and get the complete the fiscal analysis of this. And I'm not sure in the other body. I believe they attached this to some larger bill, and I want to find out what happened so that we can match things up appropriately. But I do want to make sure we understand the costs, and I will say that as we look at that, when we get those, some of the things we've done, we may have to adjust. And I'm perfectly willing to do this. I'm not trying to create this financial burden here. But I do think that the idea of trying to make sure that we're getting an opportunity to look at where costs are going and that we have a process that can do that and some exposure to that. And as I said, I'm also interested in making sure we take a broad look. I think those are laudable goals and ones I certainly support. So if it's all right with you, I'd like to ask that we lay the bill over till we get the fiscal notes appropriately done and then take it up again and look what we need to do next.
Am I up next on the next bill, Mr. Chair?
You are. The next one on the list. Is it going to be as lengthy a bill as the one we just talked about?
I hope not.
How many amendments do you have?
I have no amendments for the next one, so Lori. So I could quick run out and work up a few if you'd like, but... thank you. Senator Nino, we'll take up Senate File 1165.
I bet you're right.
Senator Nenow, when you are ready, Senate File 1165.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before we get started, there are two amendments that the Council has that I would like to offer. I believe they are the A5 and A6. Is that correct?
We'll have those passed out. And
Madam Chair, I do not have a copy, so if I could have one.
Senator Nenow, would you like to explain them?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is just really some clarifying language to make clear, almost comfort language,
sure.
If you will.
Restructuring, okay. Senator Nenow moves the A5 amendment. All those in favor, any questions to the A5 amendment? I'm getting that passed out. Maybe I should wait a little bit.
Everybody has a chance. Is this author's amendment?
Yes, it is.
Families need. Child find assistance? What is this?
Oh, yeah, I guess I do that one. That's okay.
Any questions, members, on the A5 amendment? All those in favor of the A5 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted. And Senator Nenow, you have the A6 amendment, and that's an author's amendment. Any questions on the A6 amendment? You don't have a copy yet?
We don't have any amendments.
I'm sorry. I'm kind of running through this.
Madam Chair, as that's being handed out, I'll also clarify on the A6, again, somewhat of some clarifying language, some comfort language, but also outlining a couple of different approaches depending on the circumstance if there is.
This is the A6.
If there's substantiated maltreatment or not, and it just spells, excuse me.
Senator Nenow, the very on line 6 of the A6 amendment, the Commissioner of Human Services shall monitor referral rates. I've just been informed from Council that could present a fiscal issue. If somebody from the department would like to verify that or exclude that, I'd appreciate that before we go ahead and adopt that. Somebody from the department would like to?
Madam Chair, while we're waiting for them, I do understand that there is a local impact note or statement, whatever we call those things. So we may end up having to lay this bill over for possible inclusion into a larger omnibus bill to make sure that we have our arms wrapped around that. But specific to this, if there's any comment, that would be helpful at this time, clearly.
Senator Nenow?
Madam Chair, I'm being told that the department was talked to prior to having this amendment drafted, and they had indicated that they could handle that without having to assess a fiscal impact of that.
Any questions on the A6 amendment? Author's amendment?
Yes, I can.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted. Senator Nenow.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. In deference to a short time here, maybe we could just get right on to some testimonies.
That'd be great. Senator Nenow, you have. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Legislative Affairs and Advocacy Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota, and I want to thank the committee and Senator Nenow for bringing this bill forward. This bill updates Minnesota State Statute concerning interagency early intervention committees to reflect Minnesota's current child protection policies. So infants and toddlers at risk of developmental delays as a result of reported abuse or neglect are referred for an early intervention screening to determine if they are meeting developmental milestones. Current Minnesota law requires that interagency early intervention committees implement child find systems to actively seek out, identify, and refer infants and toddlers with or at risk of disabilities who currently are involved in a substantiated case of abuse or neglect. This bill and the proposed amendment require these IEICs to find and refer infants and toddlers for whom a child maltreatment report has been accepted for an investigation or assessment. This language change reflects our current child protection system that has been in place for the last 6 or 7 years. And let me just briefly speak to that change. In 2000, Minnesota piloted a more flexible, less adversarial, strengths-based approach to child protection in 20 counties. By 2005, all Minnesota counties had integrated this new approach, family assessment response, into their child protection response model, thereby creating a two-track child protection system. So there's family investigation and family assessment. So family investigation is used when there's reason to believe that substantial child endangerment or a serious threat to a child's safety exists. This investigation track is only used in 1/3 of child maltreatment reports. And when a report is screened through this family investigation response, the neglect or abuse is substantiated or unsubstantiated. Whereas the second track, that family assessment track, which was that new second track that was added, it's used when there isn't an allegation of substantial child endangerment. It's used in 2/3, so it's used primarily for child protection cases, and again, it's building on family strengths. The important piece about that is that in family assessment, neglect or abuse is not substantiated. So that's why we needed to have this update to the statute that then would then say that if a report is screened in, if it's going then through either assessment or investigation, that the children involved in those reports would be eligible for that early intervention referral. The policy proposed in this bill, as I just shared, only applies to infants and toddlers under the age of 3. We know that these early years are a time of rapid and critical brain development. In fact, 90% of brain development occurs during a child's first 5 years of life. And we now know that early experiences, affect the way a child's brain develops, and that adverse childhood experiences, such as abuse and neglect, can produce toxic levels of stress and disrupt the architecture of a child's developing brain. Research shows that children who are reported for abuse and neglect are at high risk for physical, developmental, and emotional delays, and the risk is greatest for very young children. And just as a way of fact here, in 2010, 6,000 infants and toddlers were reported for maltreatment in Minnesota, and 75% of those reports were for child neglect. These early years in a child's life provide a significant opportunity to intervene and change the trajectory of a child's life. But in order to be the most effective, interventions must be early. In addition to the improved well-being of a child's life, early interventions can also lead to substantial community cost savings over time. And these savings can be captured in a variety of areas, including reductions in child abuse and neglect, criminal behavior, public assistance use, substance abuse, and special education costs. In fact, according to a 2009 MinLink study that followed children over time, including some children who were involved in the child protection system, 1/3 of children who received early intervention services did not go on to need special education by second or third grade, 1/3 of children. So there are two things that I would ask you, in addition to what we've just shared, but two things that I would ask you to keep in mind as you hear the testimony on this bill. The first thing is to keep in mind child well-being. Our state's child welfare, child protection system is responsible for ensuring three things: safety, permanency, and child well-being for children who are reported for abuse or neglect. For purposes of today's bill, I ask that you focus on that last piece, on child well-being, and on the well-being of infants and toddlers who are screened into our child protection system. Ensuring the children who we already know are at risk for poor outcomes are being referred for an early intervention screening is one significant, efficient, and cost-effective way that we can improve the well-being of children. That second piece, costs and savings. Ensuring that Minnesota's youngest members have access as early as possible to the services they need is both just and cost-effective. Early intervention services that will help ensure that children are ready for the joys and challenges of kindergarten, for example. And though our current framework, as Senator Nino was referring to earlier with the local impact note, though our current framework does not allow us to capture and measure long-term savings, I urge you to weigh the benefits and the burdens, short-term and long-term, child-focused and state agency entity-focused, when you decide whether to intervene early in the life of a child who has been reported for abuse or neglect. keeping in mind that early intervention services can help get children on track for early development. Please vote in support of this bill, which helps prepare our youngest Minnesotans for school and a healthy future while also paving the way for Minnesota's future prosperity. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzsimmons. Are you familiar with Robin Carr Morris, Ghosts in the Nursery, the book?
I am not.
Oh, she was an expert on this, and my little community of Fairmont hired her to come in. She's from Portland, Oregon, and she spoke for two nights in our opera house to law enforcement, daycare providers, teachers, the medical community about the early intervention issue and the brainstem development of these children. This was about 8-9 years ago. This was a pretty aggressive for this community that pulled some money together and had her flown into. And then, of course, now you have MELF and you have a lot of focus on prevention and early intervention. And I think it's just very, very important for these children because we can prevent it and we can turn it around fairly quickly, too, if we get to them early. Is there any questions from the committee? Oh, Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My attorney to my left and I have a question on how does one... What's the phrase, Scott?
Substantiate a case.
How do you substantiate a case of child maltreatment?
Ms. Fitzsimmons.
We have language in here about it, but it does never say how that goes about. Mm-hmm. And on the A5 amendment that we adopted, we have a reference to a child for whom a child maltreatment report has been accepted for investigation. Not that it has been found wrongdoing, but it's been accepted for the investigation. We're just kind of unclear about that whole thing and how that works.
Right. Thank you, Senator Higgins. Ms. Fitzsimmons or Senator Nino? Or department?
I saw movement. I wasn't sure if someone wanted to come up and speak to that. You want to speak to that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Higgins, my name is Marcy Jeffries, and I'm with Children's Defense Fund.
Marcy.
The Children's Defense Fund, and when a call comes in, a screener decides at the county level whether the call reaches enough level of concern, indications of concern, whether they're going to screen it in for more investigation or screen it out and not do anything more with it. If they screen it in and they think there's a real risk that a child's in real serious danger or immediate danger, they'll send it down the traditional investigation track that Alex talked about, and there's things in law describing what substantiation maltreatment is, and maybe lawyers can speak to a little bit more of that particular issue. But that means likely can be used in court in terms of a child in need of protection petition. So it's a legal process. The rest of the kids go down this family assessment track where they think there's probably some issues, the family could use some help, but for whatever reason, they can't substantiate it. I mean, some people talk about, well, if there's not a bruise, something we can see, we can't substantiate it. But we know from the conversation and what else we pick up in the setting, that's probably some issues we need to deal with. Okay. But substantiation often comes down to physical evidence.
Do you understand? Okay, then, Madam Chair,
Senator
then
Higgins?
I have a question on the existing language on page 2.5 does not make sense. It's one of the bullets is, the committee must implement policies and procedures concerning the following duties, and then there's number one, and then there's number two. You'll eventually get down to the meat of it, which is this implement, starting at implement. And it says, implement interagency child find systems designed to actively seek out. Is there a system called the child find system? And if so, what is it, and why in the world would we call it that?
The hawk. She's here. She goes over this stuff. Senator, Ms. Jeffries.
Somebody has to read it.
That's right. You're good.
Senator Higgins, there is a child find is actually something they talk about in the education committee. That notion of going out and actively trying to find these young children who aren't in school. So you have to find children who are in high-risk situations. A lot of it is children who were, say, born prematurely or have a medical condition, and so they are able to identify those children more easily and offer them services. But the notion is to find children who are at risk before these, whatever the delay is or the condition, has an impact on their development that will worsen over time.
Madam Chair, could we not rewrite that to say implement systems to find children or to actively seek out, identify, and refer children and infants, blah, 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 rather than this very bizarre phrase? Maybe you all who are in education, this doesn't bother you. But I've read this sentence about 9 times while we were having this bill presented. I couldn't make sense of it. So
Senator Riggins, perhaps council can figure out something for you to make it better?
Yeah. Madam Chair and Senator, I can work on it, but this is under the education chapter of law. It went to education already, but if you want me to try to figure something out to make it more, I agree, it's confusing.
Senator Higgins, this bill does have to be laid over, so perhaps that would give us a little more time to work on something and check it out with education.
That would be great if we could actually turn it into language anybody could understand, including me. Thank you. I'd appreciate it.
Senator Higgins, we do appreciate your diligence on this. You're very good. You always have been. You pick out stuff that normal people don't pick
I'm
out.
Sorry.
I don't mean it that way, sir.
Madam Chair, you meant normal in the nicest way.
That was a compliment, Senator Higgins.
See if I call you my lawyer anymore.
We're going to split you two up over there.
That was a good
My apologies, Senator Reno. Ms. Jeffries, you're up there. Would you like to continue on with anything else? You are on our testifying list. Is there anything else that you'd like to say?
Thank you, Chair Rosen. I think I'll make the concluding remarks.
Okay.
Other people
Super.
Would like to
Thank you. Any more questions for Ms. Fitzsimmons? Further questions? Thank you, Ms. Fitzsimmons. Appreciate that.
Thank you,
Senator Nino, we have Ms. Reen, legislative coordinator from the counties, and Ms. Broomfield from Scott County. Welcome.
Trying to learn about the microphones in this room. Madam Chair, I'm Julie Ring. I am the legislative coordinator for the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Health and Human Services Policy Analyst. And I'm just going to refer you all to the local impact note that Senator Nienau mentioned. I know that this is a process that is a little bit unfamiliar. We don't get a lot of these. But this local impact note, starting on the second half of page 4, lays out some analysis that MMB did with our input on the potential cost to county human services of this language. And all that I will say in summary related to that is, as you know, resources in this area have been declining. Counties have sustained reductions in the past year in the former CCSA block grant that helped us to do some of this work. And as a result, we appreciate you being attentive to the additional costs this might raise for counties. And with that, I'm going to ask Ms. Brumfield to speak a little more in depth to the content.
Thank you, Ms. Green. Ms. Brumfield.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to present some of the county issues tonight. My name is Judith Brumfield. I'm the Deputy Director of Health and Human Services in Scott County and representing MAXA and the AMC tonight. Counties strongly support the IEIC process. We use it a great deal, both in child protection as well in all of our developmental disability programs. So we work very closely with them. And we very consciously look for children and families where this might be an asset to them and make those referrals. We also are currently making referrals anytime there's a finding of maltreatment in a family with a child 0 to 3, because we know those are children who are at very high risk. But we do have some concerns about this bill, and the concerns are not about trying to address more children or even trying to do more child find or finding more children who need this service. It really has to do with two issues. First of all, when Child Protection makes the referral, there is an assumption that there is something going on in that family that may be either abuse or neglect. The reality is we make a finding of maltreatment in only 17% of the families we see. So we are concerned about Child Protection making that direct referral and the implication that there is some maltreatment or some poor parenting going on in that family when that might not be the situation at all, and in most cases is not the situation. More importantly, and this really goes to the fiscal note, is that this will cost counties additional money, which means an increase in property tax since most of the funding for this program is county money, or the alternative, which is a decrease in services that we provide families now. And that's the more likely one. I don't think in reality any county is going to come forward and raise property taxes next year in order to fund this program. Therefore, we're going to reduce services to the families we know are the most in need, those families who have children who are already active in the child protection system, and we will have to take time away from serving those families in order to make these referrals, because it will be timely, very time intensive, to make this kind of referral on a regular basis. So while we say it's a good idea, we would strongly recommend that this legislature look at more early intervention, more prevention programs. Certainly we all see the need for those kinds of things happening to families. We would stress that you need to do that by really taking full responsibility for it, doing an assessment of what the cost would be, and then funding that appropriately at the state level rather than moving it to the property tax. Because in reality, we will be losing services to our most vulnerable children in Minnesota if this new requirement is put into law. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Blumfield. Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Brumfield, I was very interested in your testimony. I know that we have fought to not cut the CCSA grants that have really helped us kind of get upstream of this issue. And so, you know, I'm very sympathetic of the issue, and I am sympathetic of how much you guys have to bear in the child protection system. The question I do have, so with that being said, the question I do have is, are you saying that that the issue of what costs so much, or even as we laid it out in the local impact or the fiscal note, is that it's going to take you a lot of time to kind of make the referral? Because if that's the case, so I'd like to hear that, because it seems to me that a lot of that information is already given to you, and you're essentially kind of taking the information you have and just kind of inputting it into the referral system that's very automated. So that's question number one. And then question number two, which I also thought I might have heard you say, but I wasn't for sure, is that if indeed we refer more kids to this process, that means that we have to spend more resources in delivering services to those children who have been referred, and that also will take away from the families that are in most need. Were those two things correct?
Senator Hayden, are you referring to part two on page four, that very last bullet point? Says County Human Services representatives or members of the EIC, the committee workloads are not expected to increase because their responsibilities are primarily process development and oversight. For this, MMB does not anticipate an increased cost. Is that your first question, basically?
Well, I guess I was just trying to get an understanding of her testimony around kind of why the counties feel like it would cost them more, and thus she made a connection to it then taking away from services that they deliver already. So I was just getting some clarifying.
Ms. Blumfield.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, counties estimate, and this was a poll really of most counties looking at workload study and time study, that it would take an additional 30 minutes per case to make this kind of referral. Now, you're right. Actually doing the online referral form is very quick. But counties would need, first of all, to get permission from the family, get a release of information, because this is not information we can just automatically send. So that means time talking to the family, explaining what it is, hopefully trying to convince the family this would be a good idea. And understand, coming into the child protection system, they're probably not going to want to sign a release of information. So that takes time. Then you do the referral. And then you have to document within your case record that you have done the referral. And then furthermore, if you released any kind of health information, then that comes under the HIPAA regulation, so you have to document that in a different place. So it's the paperwork required along with the meetings with the family. Your second question about the loss of services, it really has to do with if we do 5,000 more referrals at 30 minutes per referral, that amount of time will be taken away from other services we're currently doing if we don't increase staffing. And I'm assuming we won't increase staffing. Therefore, that many hours per year will be taken away from the services we're currently providing families in order to do this new referral.
So, Madam Chair, well, thank you. I think that helped me. So if you were, so you would think that this is a good idea. What the problem that the counties are having is that they don't have the resources in which to implement it. Is that, so I just want to be clear that we, that the practical issues that the counties have, I'm very sensitive to, but I want to make sure that that doesn't resonate into the issue of actually referring what we consider to be some high-risk children and families for services.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, counties do now, beyond those we're required to refer, if we see a need, we make those referrals. We do see this as a very important resource to families who need it. And I, as counties, we don't see a problem with increasing the number with the qualification that I think it does say something about families that we don't necessarily want to say. So I'm somewhat concerned about that. But overriding that, no, I think it's a good program. It is simply that right now, it's which is more important, treating the children where they're active in the child protection system or making referrals to children for this early intervention.
Senator Hayden?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
No problem. Any further questions for Ms. Ring or Ms. Broomfield? Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Senator Nienau, we have Ms. Jane Kritzman.
Yes. Good evening, Madam Chairman, Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Jane Kretzman, and I do have just some handouts for the committee, which I'm not sure you can read later. I am a senior fellow at the University of Minnesota now at the in the College of Education and Human Development, where I lead the Project for Babies, an initiative which aims to connect the science of child development with policy and practice. Some of you may recognize me from the project's partnership with the Council of State Governments Legislative Leadership Institute, which we conducted for Minnesota legislative leaders in 2009 and 2011. I am not here to speak for the bill, but I am here to speak about the science and to provide a very brief synopsis of what we have learned from decades of research from multiple disciplines. The infant and toddler period of development represents a unique phase in the human lifespan. It is unlike any other time in life because development during this period is so rapid. It is also holistic, meaning that growth happens simultaneously across physical, emotional, and cognitive domains. You can't have one without the other. It has been said that 90% of brain development happens by age 5. 85% occurs by age 3. As some of you know, there are three kinds of stress that we talk about in the world of neuroscience: positive, tolerable, and toxic. Positive is normal, occurring in everyday life, getting a shot, learning to say goodbye to mom. Tolerable is the unavoidable adversity that occurs in life: death, accidents, war. Toxic is the unrelenting, unbuffered by a caring adult stress that is traumatic and leads to disruptions in the developing brain. We call this toxic stress, it causes persistent fear and chronic anxiety. And this is the worry that we have in terms of development, because children bring themselves to development. They bring genes and their early experience, but their own experience of development, thank you, is something that actually is the third variable that we are now learning about. So it's thinking about this in terms of building a house, that when we have a strong foundation, we are able to build, it contributes to the larger soundness of the house, and to the extent that it can also constrain what that house can become. So scientific evidence on this point is building. Science shows that early exposure to toxic stress can trigger both this changes in the architecture of the brain, but also prolonged activation of the body's stress response system. Child maltreatment is a significant source of toxic stress. Most of us are familiar with the Adverse Childhood Experiences study. We now have new biological evidence that links maltreatment in childhood to greater risk of adult heart disease and other problems in the immune system. Early intervention can prevent the consequences of early adversity. The good news, rapid development means that with intervention, a return to normal developmental trajectory can happen. From the combined wisdom of science, practice, and common sense, we derive the lesson that improving the health and developmental outcomes of young children requires approaches that are multidisciplinary and multigenerational. The National Scientific Council on the Developing Child has published a working paper entitled Persistent Fear. I've left that with you today. And we need to consider that child welfare policies and programs that are mandated to assess and intervene in cases of suspected or confirmed abuse or neglect must address the full range of children's developmental needs, not just to focus on their physical safety. So I want to thank you for this time and just state that there is this undergirding of science, which I think is helpful in considering this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions for the witness? Sardino, have you any other testifiers?
Mr. Chair, I don't have a list. I'm not aware of anyone else, but there.
One more.
Chair Marcy Jeffries for Children's Defense Fund. Again, I have some handouts, and I'll try to be really brief. We just feel like we need to address the issues that were raised in the local impact statement. And we want to acknowledge the county concerns. CDF has advocated and continues to advocate for more money for county social services, but we really think this bill has a really minimal impact on county expenses, and it will have a major impact in not too short a time in terms of some savings that will be seen both in the county system and in the education system. And there's a real sense of urgency because 75,000 children are born every year, a small percent, but too many are reported for abuse or neglect. And we'll start feeling immediate effects from the suspected abuse or neglect if nothing is done to address it. Just briefly, we think the 30-minute estimate from the counties seems too high. We're passing out the online referral that the Department of Education requires. There's just a few things that have to be filled in: the name, the age of the child, contact information, the name of the person making the referral. We're also passing out the paperwork required by DHS. All that's required is that there's a check mark whether they made the referral or not, or if it was not required. I've talked to other child protection county staff who did not think that the referral would be an additional burden or add substantially to their workload. We'd also note that the fiscal note cannot capture the savings that come from the reduced stress and the assistance that parents will get, which we believe is likely to reduce their involvement in future child welfare reports, and so the counties will see that saving. The fiscal note can't capture the lifetime impacts of early intervention in terms of reduced need for remedial services or chronic health care. We would note that there's a national study that while social workers may be attending to the child, they miss developmental delays about three-fourths of the time because you really need the standardized screening tools that the early intervention system uses. And so relying on social workers to find those delays and refer children will mean you'll miss a lot of children who could benefit. Similarly, the fiscal note doesn't capture the savings and the in the education system, nor does it capture the cost. The way we're currently not identifying enough children, as a fiscal note says, the kids that are identified earlier will eventually be identified by kindergarten, and that was their assumption. If we don't identify them until kindergarten, the harmful effects of the abuse and neglect will have been much greater, and the intensity of the services needed will be stronger and more costly. We do think there are some efficiencies. This bill really brings together these two systems that are somewhat siloed, and by increasing the coordination between the two of them, we think there'll be greater efficiencies. There's also been some changes in the federal regs that increase the efficiency at the early intervention system level. So those are the points we want to make about the local impact, and I'll just
sum up that we think this is a good idea of translating the brain research into policies, and it'll be better, reduce costs, long-term public services demand for services, and we'll avoid the unnecessary loss potential that these adverse early childhood experiences can result in if unaddressed, and more children will be able to contribute to our state's healthy future. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for the witness?
Mr. Chair, just a comment, and it's very nice to see Ms. Jeffries back at the Capitol.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
Thank you. And, Senator Eno, I believe your request was to lay this over for inclusion, possibly, or is, do I have that right?
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, we've switched back. I mean, if you're comfortable letting it go, I'd make that motion, but if you'd prefer to keep it here to put it in the context of a larger package, then that might be the appropriate motion to just lay the bill over.
Senator, you know, we can certainly let it go if you like. Judiciary has requested it.
Okay. I was unaware of that, Mr. Chair. So, sure, let's do that.
All right. So why don't we do that?
I'll make that motion.
Sir Higgins.
Before we go, we talked. I talked about a sentence that was really unreadable on line 2.6, and I think Senate Counsel's got something figured out for us. I think Ms. White's got it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, on line 2.5, after systems, insert as defined in 125A.27, subdivision 11, that are. It's a cross-reference to the interagency child fine systems, which is a defined term. It gives this that term a little bit of context within this paragraph.
Ms. White, can you read that? As defined in section 125...
A.27, comma, subdivision 11, that are...
Okay. That are designed to actively seek. Okay.
And I'll move that, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Higgins moves oral amendment as stated to Senate File 1165. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Amendment adopted. And Senator Nenow moves that Senate File 1165 as amended be passed and referred to Judiciary. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you, Senator Nenow. Thank you, testifiers. Thank you, committee. We are, I think, under call. And so we will take up tomorrow morning at 10:30.
Oh, we're not coming back?
Senator Higgins, I don't know how long floor session will be, and I would hate to say we'll come back at some undefinite time. So
bless you.
So until tomorrow, we are adjourned.